Welcome to Crossroads, a podcast that explores the intersection of faith and Christian living. Crossroads is part of the media ministry at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. Get to know us by visiting us online at fapc.org.
Hi, I'm Jamie Staley, Director of Christian Education here at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church. Welcome to Crossroads in the Living Room podcast. We have a great series this fall, and this month I'm excited to be sitting down with Reverend Werner Ramirez to talk about his sabbatical that he took this summer. Werner, what is a sabbatical?
Well, first of all, it's so good to be back. For those of you that don't know, I was away all summer. I was gone June, July, and August. And usually when people think of a sabbatical, they think of professors taking a sabbatical from teaching to do some more research. And for some pastors, depending on the church context, but here at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church, our clergy are allowed to take a sabbatical after 6 years of service. And I started here at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in September 2017. So this last homecoming was my ninth homecoming.
Wow.
So I was eligible for sabbatical last summer, but with Augie being not even close to a year old, there was no way a sabbatical was not going to feel like a sabbatical with a 9 month old. So I delayed it a year and I took it this past summer. And I was fortunate enough that I applied for a grant through Christian Theological Seminary. And this grant is funded by the Lilly Foundation. And I got some funds to be able to do what I wanted to do. Their prompt was, what makes your heart sing? Mm-hmm. And as I thought about the stuff that makes my heart sing, like soccer and theology and friends and family, I summarized it by saying, I think what makes my heart sing is home. Mm-hmm. So my pitch was to discover a theology of home. And I was lucky enough to get the grant, which helped pay for the trips. And it also had Baron here for the summer. It helped pay for a replacement for the summer for me. And yeah, that worked out really, really well. But the word sabbatical means to rest, but in Hebrew, it literally means to stop. So I kind of stopped working for the summer, which I know is a great, great privilege. And I got to rest my body, my mind. It was really rejuvenating.
Mm, wonderful. So you didn't actually stop, though. I mean, you went everywhere.
Yeah. I didn't just sit down on a couch and watch Netflix all day. I did that maybe 2 days. But yeah, we were all over. So the way I pitched the idea was my theological home, which was Scotland, because Scotland is essentially where the Presbyterian Church started. Mm-hmm. And then we did a weekend trip to Belgium, because Belgium is the home of beer. And I am a big craft beer nerd, and that's the home of beer, so I wanted to go. We spent almost about 4 weeks in California, which is my childhood home. I was there, yeah. It was my childhood home. After that, we went to Guatemala, which is my ancestral home. But I was born in Guatemala, came to the U.S. when I was 5. So my childhood home was California.
Absolutely.
And then after that, we went to Guatemala for 2 weeks. And it was all really fantastic.
It sounds like an amazing, amazing summer. So I want to dive in to each part of your sabbatical and just hear a little bit more about your experience, as well as where did you find this theology of home? So let's start with Scotland, the home of Presbyterianism. I know that you visited some sites that were really meaningful to you. What were some of the things that, some of the highlights that you felt really impacted your theology of home in Scotland?
Yeah. I think you'll see this theme in almost every spot that I went to, that these kind of existential moments that I had of home were actually in sacred spaces in churches. But Scotland is amazing. I'll start off by saying this. The people in Scotland were extremely kind. They weren't just nice. Like, they were very kind. So the hospitality that I received made it easy to to feel like Scotland was part of my home, even though I have no Scottish genes in this Guatemalan body. The hospitality was kicked it off well. One of the first things we saw was this huge statue of John Knox. And John Knox is this reformer from Scotland that really kicked off the Presbyterian Church or the Church of Scotland by arguing with the monarchies. But we saw the statue and I was like, whoa, there's the statue. And my mom goes, is that Dumbledore? John Knox looks a lot like Dumbledore.
All right.
We went to John Knox's house and to learn more about the ways that he advocated for common people, and wanting to focus Jesus as the head of the church, and not the monarchy, and I don't know. It made me think about when we think about our faith and nationalism, and sometimes when it combines, like it gets messy. And even though he messed with it a little bit too. Like
he was a little messy.
Yeah. But it was just, it was interesting to see that like some of the stuff we're facing now, like they faced it back then. But yeah, it was just incredibly intriguing. But one of the places that I had this kind of existential moment was at St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh. Every day, I think it was at noon, they have a 15-minute prayer service. So it's a busy place. There's tourist people come to Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church, but like not like the cathedral there. So they essentially kind of stopped the tourism for about 15 minutes. One of their clergy people come up and they read some scripture. They do a prayer. Like a 3-minute homily, which is my style, like just very short homily.
You found your home.
Yeah. As I sat down to like take this all in, like I was literally brought to tears because it was the first time that I was able to worship and not be at work. For the first time in a really, really long time.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to partake in leading in the worship, which I love to do.
Absolutely.
Like I'm glad to be back and leading and helping leading in worship. But it was nice to partake of that. Mm. So that was incredibly beautiful. Mm. And then at the Greyfriars Kirk, another church in Edinburgh, again seeing some of this resistance and protest. That church had this national covenant that was signed by these reformers in 1638, where they signed a document that said, like, the monarchy is not the head of the church. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. And it was just very Presbyterian. Like when we do confirmation with the confirmation student, that's one of the questions that session asks them, like, hey, who is the head of the church? And when we do confirmation, sometimes like, is it Scott? I'm like, no, it's not Scott. Like it's Jesus. And this strong emphasis that the person we worship, the person that we believe is our savior, the person that we believe is love for us, is the head of the church. And in Scotland, that declaration was not just bold, but it was. It got violent at times because of that.
Yeah.
Persecution for that. For having such a strong declaration that the monarchy is not the head of the church. I felt like I walked into this area and there was these cloud of witnesses that were there before me.
Amazing, amazing. Sounds like you had a bit of time to have your own cup filled, as someone who works in a church.
No, absolutely. And there was those moments, but also Scotland is just so freaking beautiful.
Oh.
Like that was just Edinburgh. We went to St. Andrew's and seeing the ruins of old cathedrals that oversaw the water. We went to the Stirling Castle. And the views there were just, I mean, Scotland is just so green.
Mm.
And then in the Highlands, just being surrounded by mountains of green and running into waterfalls. And
did you meet a Highland cow?
Oh, I love the Highland cows because they got the emo hair.
Oh, the emo hair.
Yeah, it's the best.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. So let's move to another place where you got your cup filled.
Oh.
Hey-o. Belgium.
Yeah.
You mentioned before you love craft beer. Mm-hmm. And this is Belgium is the home of beer. What made you decide on this place as somewhere that would be a theological or spiritual part of your journey?
Yeah. Well, I think the theology of beer that I have comes around community, to be honest. Some of the places that I have received radical hospitality, have had amazing conversations, have been over a pint of really good craft beer. And for centuries, monks in Belgium were spontaneous brewing these beers to have something to drink, not to get drunk or anything, but it was part of daily life, and not in a way that was really respectful. But one of my favorite beers is a brewery called Cantillon, and it's in Brussels. And you could find it here in the United States every once in a while for a special event. And I've had it before, and it's fantastic. But I was able to go to the actual brewery, and it's the oldest active brewery in Brussels right now. And to see their process, to see the way tradition is involved there. And literally, there were so many other beer pilgrims at this tour.
Really?
From all over the world. and to have conversations with other people from around the world about this thing that brings us together, which is beer, was actually really spiritual as well. And Cantillon, it specializes in spontaneous fermentation, which means that they brew the beer and then they put it in this thing called the cool ship. And then the bacteria that's in the air, whatever is in the air in that season, like helps, like it gives flavor to the beer. And I don't know, I just think that's, there's resurrection there. Like there's these things floating in the air that like mean nothing, or bacteria, which sounds disgusting. But like all that stuff in the process of brewing makes something very delicious that brings us together. I don't know, it reminds me of resurrection, and that nothing is wasted in God's economy.
It's an interesting analogy. I like that.
I know you're not a beer drinker.
Not a beer drinker, but you know what I do love is Belgian chocolate. Did you have Belgian chocolate while you were there?
Yes, I definitely had some Belgian chocolate.
Okay.
Yeah, we did a day trip to Bruges, which that was more of our touristy day. And,
yeah,
definitely had some chocolate there.
So many good things in Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and then you flew back to the United States, mm-hmm. all the way to California. How long did you go straight from Belgium to California?
No, I was back in New York for about a week
and
a half. Saw a couple of Broadway shows. Saw Dead Outlaw, Real Women Have Curves. Yeah.
Wonderful. And then to California for 4 whole weeks.
Yeah, it was kind of broken up a little bit. We visited some of April's side of the family, my family, and yeah.
So I feel like this one is probably, at least in my mind, the easiest one to say, where did you find home here? But what were some of your highlights as far as, you know, where did you make some reconnections or find some spaces? Or I know earlier you and I chatted a little bit about Grace Cathedral and kind of your experience there as a sort of a change from when you were younger. So can you tell me a little bit about those things?
Yeah, I specifically went to worship to places that were influential in my life. So the church where I was a youth pastor at, where I grew up. The church that took me in to be a candidate for ministry, and visiting with former pastors and former youth group members. I had lunch with my friend Jordan, who I had not hung out in real life with in like over a decade. But we were in youth group together, and to be with our kids and to talk about how youth group was back in the day was nostalgic in a very life-giving way. And to be around people who were so critical in my faith formation, And to see how they're still, like, they were home for me back then, but they were still home for me now was really incredible. But one of the, like, existential moments I had was actually in San Francisco, which is not home for me in any kind of way. But when I was in the summer going into my senior year of high school, we went to a mission trip to San Francisco. And one of the places we visited was Grace Cathedral. And there was a labyrinth there. And I remember walking the labyrinth and being told to reflect on my spiritual journey. And that was very formative for me that summer. So I went back to that church to walk that same labyrinth. And it took me about an hour and a half to walk that labyrinth. People sometimes do it in 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. You could take whatever time you want. But it took me about a good hour and a half to, and I literally started from Guatemala all the way to where I am now, from California to Sousa Pacific University to being a youth pastor to Princeton Seminary, to, and thought about all the different people in my life that that were Jesus to me, places where I had doubts. And at the end of it, like, I looked at the labyrinth and said, and knowing that my journey's not done. And to be honest, the sabbatical came at a really good time. This is going to sound weird for your pastor to say, but I felt like God was distant from me last year. It was hard to connect with God in certain ways. And faith-wise, up here and right here, I've always been somewhat solid. But God just felt really distant. And I reflected on that year as I walked the labyrinth. And then when I took a step back and I looked at the labyrinth as a whole, I'm like, that was just a small sliver of this incredible journey God has taken me on. And knowing that my journey doesn't end with feeling distant from God, like, it's going to continue in many different ways, was God telling me, like, hey, I'm not done with you. Like, you may feel distant, but we're not even close to done. So that was one of the best highlights of the summer. But also at that church, that summer going into my senior year, we went there on a Sunday morning, and Grace Cathedral is known for being an open and affirming church, like, from way back in the day. They were huge and helping people in the AIDS crisis in San Francisco in the late 80s and early 90s. And that particular Sunday, the pastor, she had a very open and affirming sermon.
When you were younger.
When I was younger, yeah. And I was more closed-minded when I was younger. And I heard that sermon and I said, this is heresy. And when it came time to take communion, I didn't go and take communion because it was too far distant for me. And my theology on that has clearly changed. And so when I went back this time, I specifically wanted to go on a day where they were going to have a communion service. And I went back and I took communion. And it wasn't, I'm still not completely sure, like what was my intention for that? Like, was I asking for forgiveness in some way? I think maybe I was. But I wanted to highlight that my theology has reformed and it's continuing to reform in ways that makes the table wider. And yeah, it was a privilege to take communion. I pulled the pastor aside afterwards and I was like, hey, I just gotta tell you this. And she was very happy about me coming back to take communion.
Was it the same pastor?
I have no clue, okay. But probably not. Probably
amazing.
Not.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Mm-hmm. So in your time in California, you mentioned that you met with people that had meant something to you in your faith journey. Was there anyone in particular that you met with that you can just tell us a little bit about how that person was influential to you?
Yeah. One of them is Reverend Paul White. He's now a chaplain, but he was a pastor to me when I was younger. He was also my supervisor when I was a director of student ministries. And so he's been a very influential person in my life since my teens. And he more or less encouraged me to apply to Princeton Theological Seminary, even though he didn't want to lose me as a staff member. He actually never said, like, hey, apply. But, like, I know that's exactly what he did. He went to Fuller Seminary for a little bit and then transferred. And I just kind of followed that same path. But him and his wife, Jen, are people that I look up to, that now my wife looks up to as well. And to share a Mexican meal with them and telling them about our journey right now is, and to reflect on some of the goofiness of 15, 20 years ago and the shenanigans we were up to back then was really special. I mean, we try to make it a point to see them almost every time we go back to California, but this time it felt a little extra special because there was an intention of, like, thank you for being my home for so many years.
Yeah. Wonderful. So the next part, Guatemala, as you mentioned, is your ancestral home, but you also were born there.
Yes.
And you have a lot of family that is still there. Can you tell us a little bit about, well, first tell us what did you do? What was Guatemala like? You hadn't been there since you were little. I know you mentioned your parents hadn't been back in many years. Just tell us a little bit about just kind of that experience first.
Yeah. So we came to the United States in 1991. And for immigration reasons, we were not able to go back until we got our green cards. And that happened in 2004. But it's expensive to go back. So we did not go back as a family until 2007. I went on my own in 2008, and I had not been back since then. So I'm terrible at math. I think that's 17 years.
I think so.
So I had not been back in 17 years. I've seen some family. Some family has visited the United States, but there was a lot of family that I had not seen for a while, and there's many family that had not met April or met Augie. So it was really important for me to take them, but also to take my parents. I really wanted this to be a formative trip for us as a family. So we did a mixture of hanging out with family in Guatemala City and doing some touristy things. We went to Antigua, we went to Lake Atitlan, and we went to the jungle in Tikal and climbed some Mayan ruins. And it was all breathtaking. But definitely the highlight was being around family. I was able to take some family to some of the touristy spots with us as well, and sharing meals. Seeing how much they loved my son was beyond home.
And
in some ways, the family that I hadn't seen in so long, we talk a little bit over the phone, but in some ways, it feels like things didn't change from, like, even from when I moved as a 5-year-old. Like, we're now full grown adults, but there's this still connection that we had from our childhood. Yeah,
amazing. You mentioned to me that you went to the church that your parents met in. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. And that sounded like an amazing experience there. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I joke that I've been Presbyterian since the womb. My family has been Presbyterians for a very long time, even in Guatemala, on my dad's side. So my parents met at this church at Iglesia Presbiteriana El Divino Salvador, so the Presbyterian Church of the Divine Savior. And yeah, my mom lived close to that church, and one Sunday she decided to check it out, and my dad was not there, but she came back, and then she met my dad, and they were friends for a while, and then they talked about different boyfriends and girlfriends or crushes that they had. But eventually my dad was like, I think this is the one. And the way my mom says it is that the night before she prayed and said, God, I just really want a boyfriend. And then the next day my dad was like, I want to date you. But if we're going to date, we're going to get married. And that led to, and they got married about a year later. But yeah, they met at that church. My dad was the youngest elder at that church. I was baptized in that church. I call him my grandpa, but it's my dad's uncle who was a father figure to him. He was a carpenter, so he helped make some of the pews in that church. My tia Lily, who's an architect, designed the cross that hangs at that church. Like, the Ramirez family is just very ingrained in this church. And to go back, and by chance, the Sunday we were there was like a kid's Sunday. Like, the kids sing, and the youth did the sermon by putting on a play. Just so to see, I don't know, I felt like I saw my childhood, like what my childhood would have looked like in a Guatemalan way at this church that Sunday. So that was incredibly special to see. And then there were people who hadn't seen my parents in 34 years since we left. So to see people come up and give them like this long awaited hug, and it was family to them, but like family in Christ. It was just really special to see, and for them to look at me and say like, oh my gosh, when you left, like, I remember when you were your son's age. And even though I have no real memory of them, it was really special to witness.
It was special. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that there was a special fun moment, meaningful moment with Augie when he took communion there, right?
It wasn't at that church. Yeah, we went to two different churches. The other church was my cousin. My cousin is also a Presbyterian minister in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. So we went to his church that Sunday. And when we took communion, Augie loves bread. And Augie's Spanish just grew during the summer. And when we partook of the bread, he was quick to... And then he yells very loudly, "Más pan!" Like, which means more bread. And everybody giggled. It was funny. But I actually really love the theology of that. Más pan, more bread. In theological terms, more grace. I love the idea of wanting more grace from God, wanting more grace for ourselves and for others. So now, I mean, this is... Literally, Jesus said, whenever you eat of this bread, do so in my name. So now every time I see bread, I joke like, "Más pan, more bread, more grace." Yeah, that was a funny but special moment that happened in Guatemala. Yeah. One of the traveling with a toddler is so much fun and so tough at the same time. Another moment that I had was in Tikal. We're walking through the jungle, and we're going to climb the stairs up to the first temple that we were going to go up. And I didn't know what to expect. And we climb up, and then we get to the top, and there's lightning happening. But you just see, like, the ends of the world, in my opinion. The tree, like, you're overseeing every single tree that's out there. It feels like... I don't know. It's like how I kind of imagine like God creating the world, and it's just kind of like painting this masterpiece, and like it literally took my breath away. Like I choked up, and then Augie just starts having this giant meltdown. I turn to April. I'm like, we would be in one of the most beautiful places in the world, and Augie just has this meltdown because he wanted to run around, and it just wasn't safe for him to run around this temple with no railing.
Toddlers,
oh.
They're a blast.
Yeah.
So after Guatemala, you came back to New York. Mm-hmm. You were here for a little bit.
Yeah.
So you had a little time to debrief and really think about your trip.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were given this prompt and you decided to discover a theology of home, now that you've been back for a while, had a little time to debrief, what do you think you gained or gleaned from all of your experiences this summer as far as a theology of home?
Yeah, I think part of it is that home is not so concrete. In our Reformed tradition, we're Reformed and always reforming. And I feel like home is continuing to reform. Like, we went to these pivotal places that were home for me in the past. And it was amazing to be nostalgic about it, and to still feel that very presence of home, but to know that my home has reformed, like I now have an amazing sister-in-law and father-in-law and mother-in-law and extended family that are now part of my home as well. I found out this summer that I'm going to be an uncle. So our home is expanding in other ways as well. And that New York has become home for us as well. New York is brutal in some ways, and it's magical in some ways. And right now it's our home. So it's, and the part that keeps it home, I think, is this connection with the divine, with, in knowing our belovedness as a child of God, no matter what area or what relationships that we're in, that this core root of home is our belovedness.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. So where, what would you like folks here at Fifth Avenue to take from your experience? How are you going to bring it back here, what you've gleaned?
I think it's incredibly important for people to remember their journey when they can. The parts that were painful, the parts that bring joy, it's important to remember our journeys, where we came from, where we have grown. And one of the places I hope that our congregation does that is with this new labyrinth that's coming in the chapel. Is to reflect back on your journey and to see where God has been, where God currently is, and where you imagine God will be, continue to be with you as in this journey of life. And to know that God is faithful throughout all of that. Like, that God is our home. Is something I want our congregation, and honestly, everybody to know. Can I say one more? Absolutely. A couple of things. I got to give you some like top meals.
Oh, okay.
So top meals in Scotland, this meat pie at the Scran and Scally in Edinburgh, perfectly flaky crust, like the meat so tender, the potatoes, yeah, Scotland's food was not my favorite food, but that meat pie at the Scran and Scally, fantastic. In Guatemala, just the breakfast of like having some eggs, platanitos fritos, fried plantains or maduros, with beans. Augie, in addition to maspan, likes to say mas frijoles still. He loves beans. That was so much fun to have that almost every morning. And then my carne asada meal with my family in California, where my dad grills this meat and sausage, and we have rice and plant, like essentially a Guatemalan meal, but in the U.S. was fantastic. And then this prime rib dinner at the Shenandoah in Los Alamitos, California, that only happens on Fridays and Saturday, was, I think, my favorite meal of the summer.
And beer in Belgium was your favorite meal in Belgium.
Yeah, canteen. I mean, yeah, like I still have dreams about how good that
was.
It was essentially a full meal. But one of the things that going back to Scotland that was really meaningful to me was, we were in Scotland as the ICE raids were starting in Los Angeles. So in some ways it was hard to be in another country while part of my home was suffering. And I almost felt, it just didn't feel right that part of my home was suffering while I was exploring and having so much fun. But we were at this pub that was specifically a Sherlock Holmes pub. And I was wearing my LA Galaxy jacket. And the bartender comes up to me and gives April and I a free drink and says, "I am so sorry for what's happening in your city." It was just so kind.
It is kind.
To see that they acknowledged the suffering that was happening in another part of the world. Mm-hmm. And even with the simple soccer jacket, connecting that suffering to and seeing me was so good.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. It's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining me this morning, Werner. This has been really wonderful and so great to hear about your trip, but also so great to have you back. Excited for a really wonderful program year and to be able to have continue to have conversations about what home means to everyone here at Fifth Avenue.
Thank you for listening to Crossroads. Our managing editor is Jamie Staley, and our editors are Vashina Brisbane and Emily Dombrowski.